This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon to you, and this hour we'll head to Katanning just before the news at 1, see how the sheep are selling today, and shortly you'll hear about a new scholarship for junior pilots who might want to work in agriculture. It's going to teach them safe aerial mustering and spraying practices, and the scholarship will also commemorate Peter Ritter and Gavin Uren, who tragically lost their lives a year ago in a chopper crash on a Kimberley cattle station.
The mustering pilots end up being pretty known people in the mustering community because of the fact that they move from station to station. So they were both pretty respected, professional individuals who helped a lot of people, really. So to have them leave us was obviously devastating and left behind a lot of sadness, really.
More on that new scholarship for junior pilots shortly here on the Country Hour, 12:06. The state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, says it's been anticipating a big crop this season and is well on track to handle it and get it to market. GIWA's September crop update estimates WA's on track for a 23.7 million tonne crop, but wouldn't be surprised if it's a record-breaking crop of over 25 million tonnes. Of course, the weather may still put the brakes on the crop potential, and CBH has its own challenges with industrial action at the Kwinana Grain Terminal, surge issues delaying shipments at Geraldton, and grower concerns about the co-op's capacity and storage to handle a massive crop. Mick Dore is the Chief Operations Officer at the CBH Group. Mick, how are preparations progressing to handle this season's big crop?
Yeah, they're going really well. Thanks, Belinda. And, you know, it's been a while now that we've expected a big crop to come this harvest. So we've been working pretty furiously in the background to get ourselves prepared. And that includes, you know, a number of different things across the state. One of those, most importantly, being more storage. So, yeah, we've got a bit of a head start on that, which is good. And, you know, the crop has continued to grow as the seasons progress. So it's a really positive story for us at CBH and right across WA. So it's great.
Well, definitely storage is coming up as an issue that growers are concerned about. So that's going to be good just to get the details of that. Let's go through the different port zones. If we start in the north, Mick, now, as you'd be aware, weather-related surge has seen grain exports out of Geraldton significantly delayed this year. Is that challenge ongoing?
Look, unfortunately, it's ongoing in the fact that surge is something that we don't control, as obviously. And like you said, the issue here, you know, while we have surge events, it means that weather fronts are coming through, which is increasing the crop size. So the two issues, you know, one's helping us out and the other's hindering us at the port. And, you know, I think we've reported this recently. I think we're up to 37 days of surge this year that we've lost access to the berth. You know, the previous record's been 23 days, to give you some context in terms of how much impact that's had in the Geraldton port. That being said, you know, we're still in a reasonable position up there with our carry. You know, once harvest gets underway, we expect to be around 200,000 tonne of stock in the port, in the port zone, which is, you know, in line with what we would normally carry in the Geraldton zone. So it's been a frustrating year for us and getting those tonnes out, but it's we will be in a reasonably strong position once harvest gets underway.
This zone is expecting a record crop, and I'm hearing sites such as Marchagee and Arano are still full of grain. Are you having problems getting that grain out efficiently?
Again, so that all will have, you know, some storages that will have some carry. We're also building quite a bit of, you know, temporary storage up in that region as well as, you know, across the rest of the state. So it'll be, you know, located out of the way, and we'll have those sites ready to go, like I said, with, you know, a carry that we would normally expect to see in the Geraldton zone.
When harvest starts, local sites in the eastern side of the zone are expected to fill very quickly, and the concern that we're hearing from growers is that they'll then have to travel long distances to deliver grain, and that's going to cause bottlenecks and turnaround delays. What plans do you have to keep smaller sites operating as long as possible?
Yeah, so one of the key parts of our strategy has been to increase our capacity to move tonnes, and, you know, our rail fleet has as part of that, and we've seen, you know, new wagons being delivered part of that fleet has been relocated to Geraldton, which is definitely going to help us in moving tons. So we will, you know, continue to move tons during harvest to help us with that. That's not a promise to say these sites are not going to fill, but we'll do that. We've also, like I said, we've built extra storage at a number of sites in the Geraldton zone, and we'll continue to look at how we manage that as harvest goes on. But it's you know, it's an issue that we've had in the past, and we'll continue to look where we can, you know, ease some of that pressure as harvest continues.
But at the same time, you've been decommissioning and destroying sites like Gutha, for example, not so long ago. Why not put those plans on pause and use sites as emergency storage?
Yeah, look, those sites are well past their use by date, Belinda. We can't use those. Structurally, they're past being used, and the ability for us to go in there and get those back up and running is not going to work. You know, we've been through that with the growers out there, and that's, you know, everybody understands where we're at with the sites, and, you know, we're rationalising our sites, and it's important that we focus on building, you know, bigger and more suitable sites as part of the network, similar to what growers are doing across the state in terms of scale.
Let's move down now into the Kwinana region. An industrial action on both sides has temporarily been suspended at the Kwinana Grain Terminal, so no more lockouts or rolling stoppages for another couple of weeks. CBH's Group Chief People Officer Jackie Connolly saying that she's working towards a fair and reasonable agreement to be in place as soon as possible. What plans are in place to manage deliveries and shipments if this industrial action continues, Mick?
Yeah, look, our plan is to, like you've just explained, continue to negotiate with the team at KGT. You know, we are in that cooling off period, and, you know, we're working hard to get a deal done as soon as possible so that we can move on and get the harvest in.
We have to get a deal done, don't you, to avoid any hold-ups there?
Look, I mean, it's important that we, you know, focus on getting the harvest in, and we will work with the KGT or the MUA and ETU to do that and make sure that we, you know, minimise those disruptions, and, you know, we'll
are you expecting disruptions there?
No, we're not. Like I said, we've been working closely with them over the last 2 or 3 weeks to get this sorted. So,
this is the Country on the ABC right across Western Australia. Mick Dore is here today. He is the Chief Operations Officer at the CBH Group, the state's main handler, and just going through the preparations for the upcoming grain harvest. Mick, let's move to the Albany port zone, and growers are concerned about opening hours for this season's harvest. How open is the co-op to considering longer opening hours for priority bins this harvest to deal with the crop expectations?
That's not something that we've had presented to us at the moment, but as you know, we're in the middle of our grower meetings or bin meetings across the state, so they started on Monday, and we'll get feedback from growers on a range of different things, including opening hours, services, segregations, etc. at all our sites, and, you know, encourage growers to get along to those and, you know, raise any concerns they've got with the local teams and sort those out, and also good opportunity to sort of get everybody ready for harvest and update their data and in LoadNet and download their CDF app, and that gives you all the data you need to get yourself prepared for harvest. But, you know, the Albany zone is again going to be busy. We've got a number of different projects that we've had in the Albany zone building extra storage, so we again are expecting a massive crop down that part of the state, and yeah, but we've got an extra train set down there, which has been great, and, you know, we've got Broomhill and Cranbrook sites up and running. We'll have Cranbrook up and running for harvest, and that'll also give us more firepower to move tons to port. So,
what's the progress report on the new Newdigate site? Is that going to be ready in time for harvest?
It is, yeah, that's progressing well. So we've got some extra permanent storage there, which has been a long time coming, and, yeah, we're looking forward to that being in operation for harvest, which, yeah, it's all planned, all on track to be ready.
And once the grain is delivered to this site, the Newdigate site, how will you outturn it, given the site is a couple of kilometres from the end of the rail line?
Yeah, so that gets transported back to the railway line, as, you know, we've got quite a few sites like that where we truck it to the railhead, and then it's put on rail and moved to port.
And are there plans to change that in the future?
Not at this point in time. That's the mode or the method that we move the tons. Yeah, so at this point in time, that's the plan to move those tons.
The upgraded Broomhill receival site is the focus of an ongoing court battle between CBH and contractor Martinus over the build of this rapid load facility. The WA Supreme Court recently ruling that CBH was liable to pay Martinus $22 million. CBH saying it acknowledges the court's decision on this preliminary technical point and disappointed with the outcome, but CBH is pursuing its available options through the court and looking forward to putting its case forward on its merits. In light of that situation, what impact is that going to have on the Broomhill facility this season, Mick?
Yeah, well, like I said, pleasingly, the Broomhill facility is operational and we're able to use that to accumulate tonnes into Albany. And, you know, that's been one of the good success stories for us in terms of our increased capacity at the Albany or in the Albany zone. So, you know, the time it takes us now to load a train and the ability to move a lot more tonnes to port is significant, and that's why we built the Broomhill facility. It's operational and we're really pleased with how it's performing and looking forward to, you know, realising the benefits of that as we, you know, get into harvest and on from that. So, yeah,
so business as usual.
Correct. That's right. It's up and running and performing as we would like it to. So it's good.
All right. Our last stop is Esperance. And when you're driving to Esperance, the shiny new open bulkhead's almost blinding at sites like Ravensthorpe and Munglinup. So plenty of additional storage has been set up for the coming harvest. How much has been added, Mick?
In terms of exact numbers, I'm not sure, but I know we've hit a number of sites there, like you said. You've seen the Ravensthorpe and Munglinup. We've also added storage at West River and Shark Lake. We're looking at other sites as well, like Beaumont. So we've hit a number of sites in the Esperance zone, like you said, given the size of the crop down there. We're estimating over 4 million tonne, which is a big uplift in terms of what we've produced in the Esperance zone before. So similar to the other zones, lots of stuff happening down there. We've also done some upgrades at the port, which gives us faster turnaround times down there and allows us to, you know, accumulate quicker to get more tonnes through and on vessels, which is also going to be one of the key things for us at harvest time too.
Just on that, how much will you be relying on post-harvest deliveries in the US Esperance port zone just to ensure the cycle times are acceptable at some of the main sites like Chadwick, for example?
Yeah, look, post-harvest deliveries is something we've been doing for a while, and it's a combination of factors that lead to that. Growers' harvesting capacity has increased dramatically in the last few years. You know, growers are getting bigger and faster harvesting capacity or headers right across the place, and they have used bags in a lot of places to store excess capacity, and we work with growers to bring that in post-harvest. So it sort of helps both us and growers. And, yeah, we expect quite a few tonnes through lots of zones, lots of interest in the Albany zone as well. And we're also talking to growers in Kwinana and Geraldton with the same product. So it's something that works well and we look forward to, you know, working with growers on that one.
How confident are you that this extra storage is going to be adequate for this season's crop?
Yeah, confident. We've handled a similar size crop before. Plus, we had 5 million tonne of carry that year. We will be down around 2 million tonne this year with carry. You know, notwithstanding that, there will be areas that are hot spots and, you know, will fill up, no doubt, which, you know, is a good problem to have. But, you know, we'll try and manage that. We've got extra capacity that we want to move tonnes out with. We're working closely with Aurizon to ensure we've got an uplift in our rail capacity, which will help as well. So, you know, one area that continues to concern us is the Avon Valley. We've done a lot of work in that area as well with upgrades at Avon and also Killingery with extra stories there. So, you know, there's a lot of areas that we've really targeted to try and help. Again, notwithstanding that we will still have some issues and, you know, a lot of crop coming our way in a short period of time. We're as prepared as we probably can be, Belinda, but, you know, it's exciting prospect that we've got in front of us.
Mick, really good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Belinda.
Mick Dore, he's the Chief Operations Officer at the CBH Group, and just going through preparations and plans for what's anticipated to be a big crop this season, possibly a record-breaking crop, possibly on target for over 25 million tonnes. 19 past 12, where do you think the trouble spots might be this harvest? The challenges, the concerns that you have, let me know on the text 0448 922 604. This on the text: can you tell Mick that we don't want temporary infrastructure, we want some investment in permanent infrastructure belt and conveyors and decent capacity grids, none of these drive grids that are a waste of capital expenditure. The text is 0448 922 604. Well, the WA crop may be on track for a record, but there are no records in sight in the short term as far as pricing is concerned. Mae Connolly is a grain market advisor with Farmanco. She's not expecting any sudden market changes.
Oh, no, there's not really any good news to talk about with pricing in the short term, unfortunately, which is just a function of obviously big WA crop, big national crop and big global crops. So when we have those kind of production numbers, it doesn't usually translate to good prices. So, I mean, corn is the thing that's driving it all, and some of those numbers are just absolutely monstrous. So 1.3 billion, B for billion, tonnes of corn grown around the world this year, up about 60 million tonnes from last year. So to put 60 million tonnes in perspective, like, that's bigger than the entire Australian national winter grain crop of all commodities combined, even in a really good year. So that's just how much corn has increased from last year. And that largely, that's just the monster US crop that's coming that's made that difference to global numbers. But having said that, despite how scary an extra 60 million tonnes of corn sounds, guess what global corn stocks have actually done?
Tell me.
Down a couple of million tonnes.
Really? How does
that? So, ethanol, your friend and mine, so despite all these big crops, monster record production of almost everything you can talk of, and despite, you know, there's a lot of talk in some of the traders about how slow demand is, you look at the actual numbers and demand is certainly keeping up with bigger production, and it is things like growing global feed grain demand and massive increases in demand for ethanol globally. And that's repeated in wheat. So wheat, we're probably up, depending which forecast you look at, up 15 to 20 million tonnes from last year. So we're kind of approaching an 815 to 820 million tonne world wheat crop. We hit 800 for the first time last year. So production up maybe 15, maybe 20 million tonnes. But again, global ending stocks are only going to be up 2 million tonnes from last year. So big production, but increases in, especially on the feed side of things for wheat, is keeping up with production. So that doesn't really help us in the short term, but that's kind of the hope that I have for the market not staying too low for too long.
What are prices looking like in the lead up to harvest?
Yeah, so wheat kind of, you know, somewhere around the 340 mark FIS for APW1, which is only like a decile one, decile two price compared to the good prices we've largely had over the last 5 years. Probably expecting, if the finish is kind, there's going to be a lot of low protein wheat. So if you're down in the AWWs and ASW9s, probably not much over $300 a tonne for those at the moment. So pretty grim, but hopefully the yields are making up for it. And if you ask me what a good price is, if you just do the old simple yield times price and that looks good in the budget, then it's a good price no matter how unsexy it is.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been talking a lot about barley, in particular looking at feed prices and malt prices because there ain't much in between.
No, and so we've got really strong feed barley demand from China. I'm using feed barley demand from China. What that feed barley actually goes to is probably malt rather than feed, but that's okay. It's holding up the feed barley price relatively well. So we're still kind of about a 310 for feed barley, which is actually about, you know, something like a decile 6, decile 7. So feed barley is actually holding up a lot better than wheat, which, given that corn is the big monster of the world this year, you would think that out of everything, feed barley would be the commodity under the most pressure, and it's not, and that's just down to that really good demand from China. No matter what they're using it for, we love that Chinese demand.
Speaking of Chinese demand and something that's been a little bit on and off of late, canola, there are some good looking canola crops around.
Some magnificent ones, and again, if our Chinese friends would like to buy some magnificent WA canola, we are very, very happy to welcome them back to the market, which they haven't been in since for about the last 5 years. So poor old Canadians are struggling to find tariff-free homes for their canola, but that's certainly opened up opportunities for us.
So as growers head into harvest, some may have locked in some contracts, others will be looking to take cash. Given that potentially there may be some upside, you know, in 8-9 months' time, I mean, will farmers be looking at pools again? What's your sort of feel?
Yeah, and these kind of years, you know, if we're talking decile one wheat, provided we don't have a second year in a row of nothing going wrong in any wheat crops anywhere around the world, a decile one price year certainly does lend itself to a pool kind of season compared to, say, you know, a decile 10 kind of price year, where if wheat cash prices were $400 or $450 a tonne,
it'd probably
be exactly take the money and run. So, so I think all kinds of things will be on the table. Again, just bring it back to, if your yield times your price makes your profit and looks good in the budget, to just, you know, take the money and run. Either holding grain and looking to sell it for cash after harvest, which, you know, we've got a pretty grown up market these days. There are prices for the whole of next year for this year's grain, and pools are certainly an option to look to think about.
Farm & Co grain market advisor Mae Connolly speaking to Tara de Langraft. 25 past 12, and we'll stick with the grains industry between now and the news headlines at 12:30, because the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, or DAF, is continuing its efforts to recover all the imported nappy pants that could contain the capra beetle or larva that was found in a box of Little One's ultra-dry nappy pants in Walker size 5 earlier this month. DAF estimates the beetle could cost the grains industry more than $15 billion if it became endemic across Australia. About a third of the nappies were distributed to Woolworths stores in regional New South Wales. All of them have been removed from supermarket shelves, but some have already been purchased, and the public are being asked to seal the nappies in a Ziploc bag, place them in the freezer, and then contact the Department of Agriculture. Australian Chief Plant Protection Officer Dr. Gabrielle Vivian Smith says the capra beetle is a priority pest.
It's a really damaging insect and plant pest, and it's exotic to Australia. And if it was to establish here, it would pose a serious threat to many of Australia's plant industries, not just the grain industry, but other industries that have stored products. And it's estimated that it would cost the country conservatively $15.5 billion over 20 years if it was to establish.
And this case of napra beetle larva being found in nappy pants, they were imported from overseas?
Yeah, so they came in a shipping container imported from overseas.
Can we say what country?
Yeah, they were imported from Spain. Spain isn't a capra beetle country. And capra beetle is a notorious contaminating or hitchhiker pest. Often is found contaminating shipping containers where it can survive for long periods of time without really very much food. And it is quite an opportunistic beetle. So it feeds on dry products, foodstuffs when it can. It can feed on a lot of different things. And the population can kind of continue in a fairly subsistence manner until such time as conditions are really good. And then the populations can really build up. So while it's a stored food product, so, you know, home is in food storage facilities like silos and those sorts of things. It is quite opportunistic and is a perfect hitchhiker beetle. It hides away in little cracks and crevices and can be moved around in those shipping containers. So we do see from time to time, and Australia's been quite proactive in this space, the issue of feed container contamination with pests such as capra beetle.
So it came from a container ship that had come from Spain, but you don't think the capra beetle was in Spain. So it was a prior journey to Spain that the beetle got on there, you think?
Yeah, quite possibly. That's certainly one.
So we don't really know where it came from, what country it came from.
No, and that's not unusual with capra beetle because of its hitchhiking nature.
The capra beetle and the larvae that were found, were they only found in the factory? Were they found in packaging that had been sold? Were they found in the supermarket? Where were they found?
So we had a report from the public, a member of the public who purchased.
Right, so they were in someone's house.
They were within the package of nappies in that person's house.
And then you did a trace back and you found them in the factory too?
We traced to the store where they'd been purchased and then to the distributor back to the importer premises, and we've been working with both the importer premises and the importer and the distributor, which is Woolworths, to undertake survey work and treatment at those locations.
The call is still out for people to check to see if they've got these little one nappy pants in their cupboard, yep. Or because you haven't located all of the nappy pant packets.
That's right. We're working closely with Woolworths, with state and territory governments and the key industry bodies to make sure that all of the goods associated with the shipment have been traced and secured. It's very much just the little ones, ultra dry nappy pants, Walker size 5, it's a 42 pack. They've all been removed from the Woolworths stores that they were consigned to, but some of them have been purchased, and the public are being asked to not use the goods, to not dispose of the goods or their packaging, and not to return the goods to store, but to double bag the goods using plastic or Ziploc bags and seal those bags with tape. And if you can, place them in the freezer and don't move them to prevent spread, and then call 1-800-798-636 or visit the Report of Pest or Disease Concern DAF website, and then we'll contact you, so Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry will contact you to discuss the next step.
Have you had a good response from the public?
Yes, look, we've had a fantastic response from the public. People are reporting nappies through our call centre.
What if someone has used them, the nappies were soiled and they've thrown them in the rubbish and they're in a tip somewhere? I mean, is there any surveillance going on like that? Because it sounds like this beetle could survive in a rubbish dump.
That's a great question, and it is something that we have been concerned about. We've done quite a lot of work looking at rubbish dumps and also recycling centres through previous CAPRA responses that have been successful, and it would seem that those kinds of environments are very disturbed environments. They don't provide a great habitat for CAPRA to persist.
Are you confident now that we won't see CAPRA beetle become endemic in Australia?
Yes, look, we've managed it in the past really successfully, but we do really rely on ensuring that people keep an eye out for pests, that they report them promptly. We rely on working with and ensuring that importers and those working with shipping containers are well aware of these sorts of pests and report them promptly.
Australian Chief Plant Protection Officer Dr. Gabrielle Vivian Smith speaking to Michael Condon. So if you did buy the little ones ultra dry nappy pants, Walker size 5, seal them up. So in a plastic bag, a Ziploc bag, or tape them up, put them in the freezer, and then get in touch with the Department of Agriculture. Just go to the DAF website. You will see the details there. Do not put them in the bin. 28-1, Jonathan Hopper is here with the headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Optus has confirmed about 480 customers did not get through to 000 as it launches an independent review into last week's technical failure. On Thursday, a network outage led to the failure of calls to the emergency number in some parts of the country and has since been linked to 3 deaths. The RSPCA has revealed WA's animal cruelty hotspots, with the Perth metro area and the southwest ranked among the worst areas. More than 7,000 cruelty reports were made in the 24-25 financial year, two-thirds of them in Perth and Peel. The cities of Swan and Wanneroo recorded the highest number of complaints, while Geraldton and Bunbury topped the list for regional WA. And a wind turbine and battery energy storage system project in WA's wheat belt has been given the green light by state planners. Following consultation with the community and other stakeholders, the number of turbines has been reduced from 40 to 23. The development will be in the shires of Williams and Narrogin. Thanks, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you for the update. Appreciate that. 27-1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Still to come, we'll head to Katanning to have a look at the sheep selling today. A very similar sized yarding of sheep to last week's sale, and prices did fluctuate according to the quality. Just before one, Tracy Kilner will go through all those details on the yarding and the prices for you. And you'll also hear about that new scholarship for junior pilots who might want to work in agriculture. First, to the Bureau of Meteorology, Joey Rawson is with you this afternoon. Joey, how are conditions across the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, so not a lot of activity as far as clouds go for the Southwest Land Division. It has been a bit of a dry spell after our quite wet winter, but we do have another cold front that's going to approach the southwest coast later tomorrow. It's only a very weak cold front, and it'll move through kind of the rest of the southern parts of the Southwest Land Division on Friday. So as far as rainfall amounts go with that, it's kind of in the range of 1 to 5 millimetres, with 5 millimetres being on that south coast and a millimetre getting up to, you know, somewhere in the central wheat belt. So there's not a lot of rain and not a lot of wind with that front, Belinda. And then on Sunday, the shower's going to just contract to the south coast, but we do have another cold front that's going to approach. And again, that's a weak front that's just going to bring showers to the southern districts and not push too far inland. So, yeah, quite warm out there at the moment, but a couple of weak fronts to provide a little bit of rain for the southern parts of the Southwest Land Division.
And then for northern and eastern parts of the state, what can you see?
Well, northern parts are also cloud-free. We do have some quite windy conditions through the Kimberley and Pilbara, especially during the morning, and the winds are fresh and gusty, and it's going to be fresh and gusty again tomorrow morning, but then on Friday things will ease out a bit. So, but as far as rain, there's only just a slight chance of rain in the far northern parts of the Kimberley on Sunday and Monday, but other than that, it's just windy for the next morning.
Great. Thank you so much. It's 24 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, there has been no rain anywhere across Western Australia. Now, it's been just over a year since a helicopter crash on a Kimberley cattle station claimed the lives of two pilots, Peter Ritter and Gavin Uren. In their honour, their friend and owner of a Perth-based flight training business, Graydon Doak, is launching an annual scholarship for junior pilots who might want a career in agriculture. Graydon says Peter Ritter and Gavin Uren both loved working in ag, and their loss has been deeply felt by many.
The accident obviously impacted a lot of people, both in the Kimberley, the Pilbara, New South Wales and down in Perth as well. The mustering pilots end up being pretty known people in the mustering community because of the fact that they move from station to station. So they were both pretty respected, professional individuals who helped a lot of people, really. So to have them leave us was obviously devastating and left behind a lot of sadness, really.
For anyone who isn't aware, are you able to explain what happened?
Yes. So unfortunately, on the morning of the 25th of July last year, Peter and Gavin were involved in an accident which was a mid-air collision shortly after takeoff at Mount Anderson station.
And you knew Peter and Gavin personally, is that right?
Yeah. So I actually had known Peter for quite a bit longer. I first met Peter when I was doing some check-in training for Fortescue Helicopters, who Peter was previously employed by in Newman. And I had kind of been flying with Peter doing all his check-in training, advanced training and upskilling probably since early 2020. I then met Gavin when he started working for Pearl Coast Helicopters, which are based out of Broome, when I started doing their check-in training in 2021, I believe. And they both pretty quickly became friends as much as colleagues and clients. And I also ended up doing a bit of mustering with them as well in quite a limited capacity. But, so they were friends, workmates, clients, and, just very important people in my life, actually.
And you've already mentioned that they were both great pilots. What were they like as people?
I love them both. Very fun people with pretty good senses of humour, pretty friendly. One thing I'll always remember is that when I went and mustered with them, they were the experienced pilots in that capacity. So the situation kind of turned, because normally I'm there doing their check-in training and stuff. And I just remember how ready Peter in particular, because I didn't actually muster with Gavin, Peter was so willing to share his knowledge and expertise that I was lacking now that the tables were turned, so to speak, and Yeah, he was actually a really great teacher. And that's one of my lasting memories of Peter in particular. Just prior to the accident, I'd just completed his qualification for him to be able to train other junior mustering pilots. And sadly, that never eventuated. And yeah, just that little community they had with Peter and Gavin and the other pilots up there, they were just integral parts of that community. Lovely people. Both of them had a very deep connection to, obviously, the cattle industry and agriculture in general. They loved the landscape. They loved the machines that they were flying and the freedom that that presented them. They loved barra fishing. And that's kind of everything that working in helicopters in the Kimberley encompasses. So they were in the right spot. They were exactly where they wanted to be.
You have just announced a scholarship in their name. Where did the idea come from to set up the scholarship, and why now?
The idea came pretty soon after the accident. Obviously, I myself, as well as many others, went into a pretty deep state of sadness. And I ended up wondering to myself, how am I going to pull myself out of this? And how are we going to do something that's representative of what they stood for, that's from us, his mates and colleagues? And I thought, due to the nature of my business, I've got the opportunity to present an opportunity which reflects doing what they love, which was flying in the agricultural sector. And it took me a bit longer to get it off the ground than probably what I would have liked. There was a bit of emotional baggage that needed to be dealt with first.
What do you think they would have thought of the scholarship? Is this something that, I mean, I'm not sure how much support there is out there for young pilots wanting to get into ag work. Is this why you think this scholarship is important?
Yeah, look, it's actually very hard for a commercial license holder to get a job. Therefore, in the process of getting their job, often their skill set can drop away, because if you don't have a job, then you're not flying. This is just an opportunity for somebody to hopefully use this as an aid to get into the industry, to upskill themselves, and probably most importantly, to increase their safety margin. So the scholarship has two opportunities available, depending on what qualifications the receiver already holds. In principle, it is an operational rating, which is called a low-level rating, which is what allows a helicopter pilot to operate below 500 feet, which of course then therefore becomes an integral skill for cattle mustering. If the applicant already holds a low-level rating, then we'll offer them 5 hours of advanced emergency training, which is probably just upskilling to a higher level than what's required in general across the industry. And hopefully that will then, they'll be able to transfer that into use in the commercial environment.
Is there anything that you would like to say to the people who knew and loved Peter and Gavin?
Yeah, I think just remember them for what they were, not how it ended. They were professional pilots. They were skilled people. They were loved. They were passionate. And their untimely ending and the nature of it is in no way, shape, or form indicative of anything other than a tragic accident.
Graydon Doak, who's the owner and operator of Jandakot Heli Co. in Perth, he was speaking to Jess Baker about the new Ritter Uren Scholarship, which he's starting in honour of his much-loved friends and colleagues, Peter and Gavin. The scholarship is aimed at supporting junior pilots who want to pursue a career in agricultural aviation. Maybe that's you, maybe it's someone you know interested in applying. If you want to, the best place is to head to Facebook and just search Jandakot Heli, so short for helicopter, Jandakot Heli, pretty easy to find on Facebook. The first winner is going to be drawn from a hat on October the 1st, so that is next week. So if you're keen, get onto it straight away. 17 to 1.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
16 to 1. Cotton production in Western Australia's Kimberley region has increased significantly this season, jumping from about 20,000 bales last year to an expected 90,000 this year. Harvest is almost complete in Kununurra, with around three quarters of the crop already picked. Jim Engelke is the Ord Valley's biggest cotton producer and says early bales are showing great quality.
We've got limited data, but of course we have commenced ginning, and the early samples that went through the testing facility based in Kununurra have indicated it's in line with our expectation from previous years, which is very good quality cotton.
Are you growing more this year than you have in previous years?
Oh, yes. We stepped up from 200 to 300 hectares for the last 6 or 7 years up to just over 4,000 this year.
Have you faced any challenges or learning experiences, I guess, in growing this cotton? I have spoken to other farmers who said there were challenges such as trying to grow the cotton to the right height because if it gets too tall, it's harder to pick. Have you faced challenges like that?
Of course, except we have a bit of experience. We've got a few years of doing it, so we're well aware of some of those things that can happen. Certainly this year we planted earlier than we ever have before, so that did throw up some things we hadn't seen before in terms of how do we manage the cotton. But look, on balance, nothing completely out of what we expected, and to nothing to suggest that we can't improve on where we've got to this point. For us, it wasn't so much about growing the cotton, it was about the logistics of planting larger areas.
The ginning season, I understand, kicked off about a month ago now. How long do you expect that it will run?
We're anticipating it'll run through to the end of this year.
And what's the first month of operation been like at the gin?
Look, it's been a commissioning month, so it always comes with its little wrinkles and challenges. But that all said, it's up and running and going pretty well now. And cotton seed is flowing out. We've sent cotton to Wyndham. That's been containerised. Seed has been moving out of the site now for a couple of weeks, I guess, a bit more. So everything's going pretty well and in line with what we expected.
Do you know what prices are like this season for ginned cotton?
Not good. they've been fairly depressed for the last few months now. So they wouldn't be exactly what we'd hoped for, but never mind. There's not much we can do about that. We press on.
Jim Engelke is the General Manager of Kimberley Agricultural Investment, known as KAI. He's also chair of Kimberley Cotton Company, which owns the $60 million high-tech cotton gin that opened in Kununurra last month. Jim was speaking to Jess Baker about how their forecast production is likely to be about four times that of last year's crop. But as you just heard, prices are not great at the moment, and Queensland-based cotton trader Pete Johnson says that's largely due to global uncertainty with trade policy.
We've got a situation where the consumptive world is a little bit scared about trade policy from the US in particular, with the various tariffs and the uncertainty surrounding that. So spinning mills haven't got certainty on pricing. They're just a cost-plus business. And if they don't necessarily know how their yarn and fabric will be treated when it arrives in the US, which is a major textile destination, then it makes them very difficult to make purchasing decisions. So that our main customers, who are the spinning mills, are reluctant to buy forward. They're just buying hand to mouth, which is keeping demand at a lowish sort of an ebb.
And so just to put into context, how do the prices that we're seeing now compare to maybe a few years ago?
At the moment, we've got pricing in Kununurra would be somewhere around $5.30 to $5.35 a bale. For instance, growers have been able to sell some forward at $5.50 and a little bit higher earlier on in August and before that. Put that into context, last year and the year before, there was pricing from $6.50 to $7.50 a bale on the East Coast. So those bales had to move to the East Coast to be ginned. Last year, were ginned at Katherine as well from the Ord. This year, they've got their gin at Kununurra, which obviously takes some of those freight costs out of the picture for them.
So how long do you think it'll be before we could see an uptick in cotton prices?
Yeah, that's $1 million question, Georgia. I guess the positive is that spinning mills keep on buying. Like they need to buy, they need to keep their spindles turning. So it's hand-to-mouth buying. It's just that they're not buying forward. And I think that if they get a signal that there will be more certainty, which would come in the form of maybe a trade deal with China or a trade deal with India, then that would give them all more confidence, no matter what destination they are, like whether it, that could be any spinning hub anywhere in the world. If they know that those two big ones have certainty, then it creates certainty for the whole market. And I think that's the sort of thing that could catalyse a little bit more forward cover and a little bit more confidence from our consumptive sector.
And so by the time the season is over this year in Kununurra, it looks like there will be about 90,000 to 100,000 bales of cotton produced, which is a pretty big jump from just 20,000 last year. Do those figures surprise you?
Look, they don't really. I think that the Ord has always had capacity for some pretty solid growth once the processing facility was constructed. And, I mean, the growers there have proven that they can grow cotton and grow cotton well. They're decent yields and the quality is some of the best that we're seeing in the country, if not the best. And they're innovative farmers. They're having a crack. The water's there. The land's there. All the pieces of the puzzle are in place. It's just getting this logistics hurdle sorted out for how to get the bales out from the gin.
Mm, that is something we keep hearing about, the teething issues, I suppose, which makes a lot of sense in the early days. So, Pete, I want to know, where do you see WA's cotton industry heading if we do keep seeing more and more hectares being planted here each year?
I think from here, like obviously there's been exponential growth over the last year because the gin has been built effectively. Now, from now, it's probably more of a slow grind. The concept has been proven. Now it's just a matter of building on the foundations and making sure that the system doesn't get overloaded. So I don't know, maybe it's 15% growth a year for a little while. What will happen with the cotton industry is it'll bring in rotational crops as well. It won't just be cotton grown in the Ord or elsewhere. There'll be sorghum crops. There'll be other industries come in, and there'll be infrastructure come in. There'll be machinery dealers. There'll be all of those service industries come. And it's not just about cotton. It's about agriculture as a whole and farming as a whole and communities as a whole. In terms of the opportunity that could emerge, I think that for the Ord growers specifically, year in, year out, it should be one of the most uniform production areas in the country, not just in terms of the quantity. Like the Lake Argyle is a fantastic resource. You will not see a drought in the Ord, whereas we will have droughts on the East Coast that will cut our production by 90% from one year to the next at times. So there's that. You'll have certainty of production, continuity of supply, and also the quality should be year in, year out, the most consistent of anywhere else, because you're picking during the dry season, you don't get the rain on the crop, which causes downgrades on the East Coast from time to time.
Principal of LFS Agri, Pete Johnson, speaking to Georgia Hargreaves about prospects for the cotton industry here in the Kimberley in WA. 8 minutes to 1 o'clock. Let's make our way now to the Henty Machinery Field Days in New South Wales' Southern Riverina region. This year is the biggest yet, with 870 exhibitors and more than $250 million worth of machinery on display. Eight innovative machines were judged for the coveted Machine of the Year award, and this year it went to a direct air injection unit made by Orange-based biotechnology company Loam Bio. Andrew Godwin is the mechanical engineer.
Basic principles, it's a steel box that we bolt on the side of an air seeder. But inside that box, we've got some electric motors that drive a metering system. So what that allows us to do is we can hold about 2 kilos of a dry powdered biological in that hopper. And with an in-cabin controller that we've also custom designed, we can regulate the rate of that product being metered back into the existing air system on an air seeder. So you're really relying on the air seeder's distribution system to carry that product down to every single furrow across the width of the machine. And the result that we're after is a very even and accurate distribution of that powder into every furrow across every hectare of your paddock.
So a lot of inventions come from necessity. Tell us a bit about the beginning of why you wanted to make the Furrow Mate and what problem you were looking to solve.
Yeah, so the problem, I guess, is how do we make the job easy for farmers to get biological products at very large scale. So most people in broadacre ag in Australia are familiar with doing seed treatment process. So if you're growing legumes and pulses, you would have coated seed with rhizobia. It's a messy, time-consuming process. It works. It's tried, it's tested, it's proven. And we know that it works for loamed products as well. It's still a viable option. But for very large growers that want to be able to do things quickly and efficiently with low mess, low fuss, that's really where this came in. So it's a way to really break into that larger operation that's looking for every efficiency they can get. The Furomate gives you that possibility then of delivering these biologicals at scale very efficiently.
So tell me, like, how does it help farmers? Like, what does it save farmers?
It saves labour. It gives you peace of mind that you can do the job quickly and efficiently without having to add in any additional steps. So you don't have to do an additional seed treatment to what you were normally doing. You can go about your cropping business as usual, but you're actually putting in an additional biological at the same time.
Does this open up the future for more innovation in this space for you, do you think, at Loam?
Yeah, definitely. So this product specifically, we're already looking at the development journey. So we have a bit of a roadmap for ourselves as to what's next. We've done all of the testing and proven for Loam's existing line of products, but the next step for us is really pushing into rhizobia. It is the number one question we're asked by growers is, you know, can we put rhizobia through this? Because we want to stop doing seed treatment. And that's the definite next step for us.
Andrew Godwin, he's a mechanical engineer from Loam Bio. He was speaking to Annie Brown about Furomate, which has just been awarded the 2025 Henty Machine of the Year. And the Henty Field Days in southwestern New South Wales is Southern Australia's single biggest agricultural event. 4 minutes to one. We will head off to Katanning in just a minute.
G'day, Nick Grimm here. Join me for The World Today. Presidential U-turn. Donald Trump tells Ukraine it can win back its territory lost to Russia. Super typhoon Ragasa hits Taiwan as it bears down on China. Rocketing countdown. NASA cranks up its timeline to send astronauts back to the moon within months. And are animal organ donations the new lifesaver for transplant patients? Join me for those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
3 minutes to one, let's head to the market. And about 12,600 sheep sold at the Katanning sale yards this morning. Tracy Kilner, hello. That's a very similar size yarding to last week's. Can you run through the prices?
Quality eased this week with light store lambs and hoggets dominating the numbers. The supply of new season lambs were lighter weights, while a large yarding of mutton saw a good supply of store lines as well as heavy weights carrying a fleece. The prices fluctuated with quality. New season lambs topped at $281 and old seasons at $294 a head. Heavy mutton gained on quality while the store mutton eased. Rams returned to normal this week, selling to $170 a head. The new season lightweight lambs made $104 to $230. Trade weight sold from $214 to $263. And heavyweight new season lambs sold at $281 a head. Old season lambs weighing under 16 kilos carcass weight sold from 90 to 170, while heavier lambs made 130 to 199. Trade weight lambs sold from 183 to $250, and heavyweight lambs sold up to $294 a head. Ram lambs made from 132 up to 254. The crossbred hoggets sold from 180 to 211. Merino store weather hoggets ranged from $127 to $170, while the medium and heavyweights returned $160 up to $227. The Merino ewe hoggets made from 95 to 180 for the lightweights. Medium and heavyweights sold from $145 up to $220 a head. The store mutton eased on quality, making from $60 to $176, while the prime medium weight ewes returned from $160 to $211. Heavyweight ewes over 30 kilos carcass weight sold from $190 up to $239. Mature store weathers sold from $100 to $141. Medium and heavyweights returned $167 to $227 a head. And the mature rams sold from $10 up to $170 for hogget lines. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much, Tracy. And the birds in the background, I don't know if you could pick that up. Could you, those birds? They were quite noisy in the background. They're lovely. 12,636 head sold today. That's sheep and lambs, down 111 on last week's numbers at Katanning. Just repeating today's top story, the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, says it's been anticipating a very big crop this season and it believes it's well on track to handle it and get it to market. And we heard from Mick Dore, the Chief Operations Officer at the CBH Group earlier, just talking about all the preparations, all the storage that's been built in preparation for what could be a record-breaking crop of over 25 million tonnes. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.